Viola Williams Reel 10.
It also had its drawbacks, that travelling, because if I was doing a night talk somewhere to an allotment association or something like that, it was quite possible to get stuck behind a convoy of tanks. And with only minute glimmers of light coming out of your little slits in the headlights, I mean, if you were stuck behind a convoy of tanks, you just stopped at the nearest telephone box and rang up and said, "I'm terribly sorry, but I'm not coming." Because you hadn't got a hope in hell of getting past some of it. And there was always a hazard.
It's the blackout, I suppose. That would have made driving rather dangerous, wouldn't it? Even without the tanks.
Driving, yes. Especially on Salisbury Plain, because in those days I don't think we had white lines, and we certainly didn't have cat's eyes. And Salisbury Plain tended to be foggy in the winter, and you couldn't see the edge of the road with minute slits in your shields on the head. And it was horrible sometimes driving at night in a fog on Salisbury Plain, because there were no edges to the roads and you just didn't know where you were going. But on the other hand, Salisbury Plain in good weather is so lovely, you know. But you just took it in your stride, and it was all part of life in those days. I don't know, one just accepted the war and all its sort of bits and pieces. And I was lucky because I was not only driving my own car, but I was also driving other vehicles for the Wilkes War Ag. If they wanted a 1500 weight going somewhere, well, you drove a 1500 weight somewhere. And if you wanted a tractor going somewhere, well, you drove a tractor somewhere. So that you've got a very wide background, which was good. I enjoyed it. But now I've enjoyed everything.
And now you're going to tell me about your enjoyment of Malaya, I think. Is that right? Because you went back, didn't you?
When I finished in West Sussex, I did six years altogether on the National Federation of Women's Institutes as their agricultural organiser. And that took me all over England, so I knew my England in those days. But while I was there, the emergency happened in Malaya, and Gerald Templer and his lady, Mrs. Lady Templer, he was the Governor General. He took over from someone who got murdered. I forget what his name was, but he was murdered on the road, the Governor General. And Gerald Templer...
Gurney, was it Gurney? Gurney.
Took over, yes, Gurney. Mm-hmm. And Gerald took over. And Lady T, who was a very energetic lady, decided that she'd got to do something about this too. So she thought it'd be a good idea to have women's institutes. So she got the government to write to the National Federation here and ask for somebody to go out and start women's institutes in Malaya. And this was in the early 50s. Yes, it must have been the early 50s. We were a very nice team up at National. Home economics, handicrafts, agriculture, and public relations, and an organising person. And so when they asked us for somebody to go out, they sent out our organiser, who was Miss Herbertson, and she went out because she was the one who organised all the startings and stoppings in this country, so she went out to do it there. And she was out there, she wasn't out there a very long time, but she laid down the organisation side of it, or some of the organisation side of it, and then whether she didn't want to stay or what, I don't know, but she didn't stay an awful long time, and they then wanted somebody else to go, and because I knew Malaya from the war, they asked me if I'd like to go, because I was on the national staff anyway. And so I went out as organiser for the WIs in Malaya to work with Lady Templar and to see what we could do about it. It took 6 days flying out to Malaya in those days. You went up, you came down, you went to bed, you went up, you came down, you went to bed. It took 6 days. And which was an experience, and of course it was all very elegant because it's all only one class and all first class, and it was all terribly elegant. And then ultimately I got up to, I stayed at Raffles in Singapore, and that was something. And then I went up to KL to Kuala Lumpur to Lady Templar. And I stayed with a peace commissioner who was terribly chuffed at having somebody living with him and his missus who was actually working in Government House. Oh boy! Oh boy! And I acted, for the year I was there, I suppose I acted as a sort of aide-de-camp to Lady T. I spent a lot of time up in Government House working with her. And then we went all over the country together, or I went on my own. And but the first thing I remember about that is the day after I got up there, I was called into the military attaché's office, and he said, "Now, Lara, I don't care where you go, and I don't care what you do. And if I have to send in a regiment of soldiers to get you out of trouble, there's going to be hell to pay." And that is something which has lasted me right up till now. When I've always, whenever I've been in a sticky situation, I've always thought back to now, who's got to come and get me out of this if I get stuck? And It was very good, because all the roads had got notices up saying it is dangerous to stop here, do not stop here, it is dangerous to stop here. All the rubber plantations were covered in barbed wire and guards and heaven only knows what, and even that didn't keep them out. Some of my institutes, some of my villages.
Yes, I was wondering what your job was going to be, having had the organisation laid down by this other woman.
Yes, she laid down it.
Yes.
I was the one that took it into the villages.
Yes, and what were you actually doing with the villages? And what were the villages at this time? Were they still the original villages?
These were Malay kampongs, yeah.
Are these the...
Malay kampongs. I'll go on to the other bit in a minute, but these were Malay kampongs. And you would... probably the district officer's wife would get in touch with Lady T and say that she thought such and such a village was all right for a WI, and that she would be prepared to help with the organisation of it. It was good for the district officer's wives because it was good for the district officers and their relations with Government House. So I mean, that was all right. And I would, if I was doing it on my own, I would drive into a village and I would stop in the middle of the village and I would wait. And after a time, the news would get round that I was there, and in about 2 hours I would probably have a meeting. And you then explained what the WI was all about. And probably the chief's wife would be there, and she'd probably take you to see the chief to make sure that it was all absolutely legitimate. And you always had to be awfully careful with the chiefs, they had their pride to consider. And then with any luck, you could get a committee together. You could arrange for a demonstration, or a class, or something, that we would try and arrange for them. And you didn't have to worry so much about ringing, you couldn't ring them up anyway, about getting them there, because you just had to go and wait till the meeting came, and until the word had gone round. So you could, it was from that point of view, it was quite simple. It was a bit frustrating sometimes, it was quite simple. And then what happened then was that we did quite a bit on childcare, we did quite a bit on dressing, on clothes, on feeding. We did quite a bit on knitting, strangely enough, and we got that dollops of wool from this country, because although it's hot during the day, it can get quite cold at night. And so they were passionate about knitting, so we did a lot of knitting. And we did a lot with food, and we did quite a lot with food preservation, which was quite good. A village would enjoy having an institute, and they would begin to feel that their institute, that their village was quite something. And then the chief would meet a chief from another village, and he'd say, "Well, what's my village got to do with this?" And so that chief would say, "Well, why haven't we got an institute?" And so it spread very much like that by word of mouth. And the institutes that started like that were the ones that lasted, because they came from the grassroots. When it was the district officer's wife, or even me, if we organised it from the top, they felt terribly important because they were being organised from the top. But when we weren't there, that was it. Whereas the ones that had started from the bottom went on. I remember on several occasions, the first we heard about an institute was an item in the local newspaper saying that such and such an institute had a demonstration or a show or something, or done something. And that would be the first we'd known that there was an institute there. So I would drive up to the village and would meet up with whoever it was in charge, and we'd shake hands all round, and then they were legitimate, and it was a model institute. It was tricky because I've been in with a tank behind me in case I was going to get attacked. I've been in with loads of soldiers behind and before me. I've been in with a helicopter because it wasn't safe to go charging around Malaya at the time. I mean, the guerrillas were just about everywhere. And you just had to be careful. It was even difficult to spend pennies because you didn't dare stop behind a bush, because in case there was a bad deal behind the bush. But it got me all over Malaya. I knew my Malaya quite well. It also, which I found was quite interesting, it got me in touch with the Sultan's wives, because in each of the states, the Sultan's wife was the head WI person in the state. It wasn't usually the first wife, it was usually the second wife. In one case it was the fourth wife, but she was very good. The fourth wife was excellent. She was young and she was very enthusiastic. But it was usually the Sultan's wives who were in charge of all the institutes in the state. They would have a committee that would do it. And some of it was I remember going up to Kota Bharu on one occasion, where the Sultan's wife was, it was the annual general meeting, it was the Sultan's wife who was in charge, and we'd gone through the agenda, and we had a good meeting, of women from all over the state, and we got on, we did all the preliminary ones, and then the wife turned to the treasurer and said, "Now, can we have the financial statement?" And the treasurer looked at her blankly and said, "The financial statement?" And yes, she said, what's happened to the money that we've collected from the institutes? Because I know we haven't used it all. What's happened to it?" "Oh," she said, "the money. Oh, yes, I'll go and dig it up." And she just buried it in a box in the bottom of the garden. That was one of the funny ones. Another one of the funny ones that I had was I got a round robin from a village right up in the hills, and they had the schoolmistress had written, "We do not like our president, please come and remove her." And the institute had all signed it with their thumbprints all the way around, like that. It really was a round robin. And it was about 150 miles to go, and I thought, well, I'll have to go up and do something about this. So I went up, and all the way up I was thinking, how the hell do you dispose of a president, an elected president? This is going to be extremely difficult. However, I arrived at the village, and by the time I got there, I got it worked out, and they all came, and we had a lovely meeting, and I said I was terribly sorry, but the last time I'd been there, when we'd done the election, and I hadn't done it quite right, and would they mind terribly much if we had another election? And they said no, they wouldn't mind. I said I was very sorry that we'd have to do this. And you see, it was also democratic, because all right, they didn't read all right, but we had our ballot papers with elephants, palm trees, tigers, sharks, whatever. And when they wanted to be on the committee, they'd stand up and say, "I am a shark, I am a tiger, I am a palm tree." And then they put their crosses against the palm trees or tigers or the elephants. So it was very democratic. It really was a democratic election. And they voted it in unanimously again. I bet that was... But sometimes, I mean, I can remember arriving in one village and driving into the middle of the village. At the same time as Gerald Templer and a squadron of troops came out of the jungle on the other side of the village. He said, Ah, Viola, now I'm going up to such and such a village, and they've got the institute there, haven't they? And I said, yes. He said, now, there's anything you want to say to them, because I can give them a message. And I mean, it was lovely the way that sort of thing worked. And but you didn't have time to be scared, I don't think, because there was always so much to do. I remember coming down on the first train, because the Japanese removed a lot of the trains in Malaya while they were there. They were using the rails and everything for other places, and they relayed the line from Kota Bharu down to Singapore. And I was up in Kota Bharu at the time, and I got a passage on the Golden Arrow to Singapore, and we just got out. There was hardly anybody on the train anyway, and we just got out of Kota Bharu when the guard came round and said, "Would you all please lie on the floor, because we're going through a very bad area and we might be shot at." So we did quite a lot of the trip lying on the floor of the train. But we got there, that was all right.
These villages, am I right in thinking that Templer's plan was to move a lot of the...
Oh, those were the Chinese.
Oh, were they? Yes. Did you go there?
Oh, yes. Mm. We had our membership certificates in six different languages. Six different languages. We had a Gurkha Institute. We had Indian Institutes. We had Malayan institutes, and we had several different Chinese institutes. But the Chinese were all being moved into what they called the new villages, which were almost a concentration camp, but not quite. They were slightly a bit above a concentration camp, but they didn't want the Chinese careering around the countryside. They got making contact with the guerrillas, which were Chinese anyway. And so, but some of the Chinese villages wanted an institute, and I remember going to one where we had it in it was a room of some sort, and it wasn't big enough, and I had to stand on the table because there wasn't room for me on the floor, and I think I had three different interpreters going, because all the Chinese were from different areas. They all had different dialects, different languages, whatever they call them. And what the last lot got, I got no idea. I mean, what they all got out of it, I don't know. But we got one or two Chinese institutes going. We got quite a lot of Indian ones going, particularly where there were railways because the Indians were very much the sort of managers of things like railways and that kind of stuff. And so we had quite a lot of Indian ones going. Our national committee was a very mixed national committee, because we tried to get somebody from everybody on it. And Lady T would open an executive meeting. Look, she'd beam down the table and she'd see all these different nationalities. And say, "Isn't this wonderful? We're all here together and we're all doing women's institutes. Isn't it wonderful? Now we'll do what I damn well tell you." I mean, she didn't say it in so many words, but that was what the gist of it was. She was wonderful to work with. If we were going to a completely new area, she and I would go together, either in an armoured car or in something or other that we can get there. And we on one or two occasions, we had tiny planes, but they were always a bit dangerous because there was a lot of wind, and there was always a possibility we were going to get blown out to sea or something. We did on one occasion, and the pilot was absolutely petrified. He got the governor's wife in a small plane, we were heading out to sea. But Lady T and I would arrive in a village, and we more or less knew what we were talking about. And Lady T would give the opening talk, and she'd give a wonderful talk about. Oh, she was a wonderful speaker, and she really would make a lovely speech. And she'd have all absolute eating out of her hand. And then when she finished, I did my bit, and I would fill in on all the bits that she'd left out. And then in the afternoon, we'd go to another village, and she would give my talk verbatim, and I'd have to fill in again. there was a lot of fun about it. And I stayed with quite a lot of planters' wives at various times, and that was always a bit tricky because they were so security conscious, and you had barbed wire everywhere and guards everywhere, and it was a lot of war going on, and I mean that was all there was to it. But by the time I left, we had over 200 institutes going in Malaya by the time I left. And
it seems an amazing idea, really, doesn't it? Given the different cultures there, yes. As you were saying, you had six languages, let alone the different languages, say, within the Chinese. It wasn't alien to their culture, the WI, obviously.
Oh, I think it's alien to everybody.
Was it?
It just depends on what you could put over, like if you got it through to one chief that it was a good thing, then he'd get his next lot to do it themselves. And I think voluntary stuff. I know that this ought to go on the record, but we had one Indian who was quite high up. She was on our national executive. And I think she had 11 different organisation badges pinned inside her handbag. And when she went to a meeting, she'd look round to make sure she was in the right meeting, and then she'd get the right badge out and put the right badge on. Because the Indians, to a very large extent, they were all right, they were prepared to be voluntary. But they were voluntary, provided that there was something coming out of the end. And either it was their husbands were going to do better with Gerald, or they were going to get something. If we had a meeting and there was any tea left over or any sugar left over, unless you grabbed it immediately, that was a perk, and that was an honourable perk for an Indian to take. And we did, we had to be a little bit careful on that, but then we had some good Indians, some good works. We had some good Eurasians mixtures. We had some excellent. I remember one little woman that in one of the very wild hill villages, and she'd had an education and she was quite promising, and we brought her on, and she finished up as assistant treasurer to the Associated Countrymen of the World. And when you could do something like that, you felt, well, all right, it's worthwhile. I don't know whether they still are there, but in those days there were quite a lot of Aboriginals up in the hills who literally hid themselves from the guerrillas, from us, from the war, from everything. They had kept themselves right up in the hills. And we thought it would be a good idea if we got a cup of Aboriginal. Oh yes, we did. So I went up to where I thought there were Aboriginals up in the hills, and I parked in the middle of an open space. And I must have stayed about 3 hours, I suppose, and the bushes all around the open space were gently waving, gently sort of moving in the... Nobody came out, but there was obviously something going on. And I did this 3 times, and the third time they came out. And we finished up with 2 good Aboriginal WIs in the hills. The only time that we thought we were going to founder, and we very nearly did, was one of the women, one of our Aboriginal women, was going to have a baby, and it was going to be a very difficult baby. Everybody knew this was going to be a difficult baby. And we persuaded her to go down to the hospital in the lowlands. And the whole tribe came to and camped round the hospital. And luckily, the baby was all right, because if it hadn't been, I don't think we'd ever have had another happen. We might even have had a riot on the spot. But they all came down to make sure that she was going to be all right. And they all camped. Oh dear. But I think we did quite a good job. And the WI is still going strong, and it's still one of the best multiracial organisations in Southeast Asia. It worked. It was cockeyed, and it was. You had to improvise practically all the time on what you were doing and how you said it and what you said. I could, by the time I finished, I could take a meeting in Malay. I can't remember any of it now. I think I've forgotten it all except Tikai, which means okay. I've forgotten it all, I think, but I because it was a limited vocabulary that I wanted for that kind of meeting, I could take a meeting with enough vocabulary to get through with it, and of course that was always a help, because I mean if you talk to people, it was a help. The meetings were very funny. If you were lucky enough to have a building to have it in, you left all the shoes behind, and the buildings were always on stilts anyway. You left the shoes at the bottom of the steps, because everybody sat on the floor and did everything. And the women always used to come, and they used to come with their babies, because they were always babies. And you could tell the success of a meeting by the number of puddles on the floor at the end. That the babies hadn't been made, they didn't want to miss the meeting, so the babies just puddled on the floor. So you could always tell whether it's a success or not by the number of puddles. But I think, and sometimes we had to take them home afterwards in an armoured car. or an armoured lorry, because sometimes it was very tricky. And I've taken lorry loads of Malay women home, lying on the floor in an armoured vehicle before now. And you had to finish usually by 4 or 5 past, but it rained. And when it rained, it rained. So